I happened to have an invitation to a come and try day with Sailability WA, and went and tried. And to my delight, there was quite strong wind that day. So I got out on the boat and it started speeding up and heeling over, and it was great fun. I was hooked from that moment. I think if it had been a very light wind day that day, I wouldn't have gone back because I quite like going fast.
Welcome back to Herstory. This series gets stuck into the stories of inductees to the Western Australian Women's Hall of Fame. My name's Taylor Strano. I'm with you each week as we meet some of the trailblazing women who've called Western Australia their home. In episode 7, we meet Kylie Forth. Losing her eyesight at the age of 3, then one of her legs at age 9 to cancer, hasn't stopped Kylie from pursuing her dreams as a world champion competitive sailor. Kylie has achieved amazing success in her field, including receiving many medals from global sailing competitions and fundraising to keep her blind sailing team lost at sea in competition. It's Season 2, Episode 7 of Herstory with Kylie Forth. This is Her Story. Let's start then with a little bit about your childhood. Tell me what it was like growing up. Did you have a big family? Do you have any fond memories of childhood?
I grew up in Cunnanoppen, which is a tiny little town in the wheat belt that no one's ever heard of except for a few people, I guess. it's a farming area, wheat and sheep, not much water around. Yeah, just small country town. I was the only blind person in the area and the only blind person I knew, in fact. I hadn't actually met any other blind people until I was about 16 or so. So I was a bit special, I guess. I have, just mum and dad, brother and sister.
It's interesting that you mentioned there was no water around, because a big part of our conversation today is going to anchor in at sea, which is
absolutely
something that you're very well known for.
Yeah.
Before we get there, though, I do want to address something that people who know you will obviously know about you, but people who are listening maybe on the podcast or on the radio for the first time. Kylie, one of the unique things about you is that you are blind. You have mm-hmm. lost vision in both of your eyes, mm-hmm. and you're also without one of your legs. Mm-hmm. That all happened pretty early on in your life, didn't it?
Yes.
Do you want to tell me about that period of time?
Yes. I had cancer as a baby. I was diagnosed when I was 18 months old. Lost my first eye immediately because it was riddled in cancer. I had retinoblastoma. And then took another 18 months of treatment, radiotherapy, chemotherapy, experimental surgeries, all sorts of random things. But unfortunately, they didn't work. So I lost my second eye when I was 3. And so, yeah, just grew up as a little blind kid running around, not using a white cane and, doing all the things wrong that I, well, not wrong, but, all the things that I shouldn't have done according to the people who knew best. And then I had I also got cancer when I was 9 in my femur. I had osteogenic sarcoma. So that, again, went through some treatment, got that amputated a couple of months later, and then had sort of more treatment as a follow-up for that. So I sort of grew up, as an able-bodied blind child until I was 9, and then sort of had all that to deal with, learning to walk on an artificial leg, deciding not to use it anymore, going from a wheelchair to crutches, and then just, basically just spending my teenage years running around on crutches, refusing to wear an artificial leg and not being able to use a cane because I was having to hold my crutches in my hand. So I had to learn how to navigate without using any of those traditional tools for people with vision impairments usually use.
It's really interesting. I'm just trying to imagine what it's like growing up in a remote town in Western Australia, let alone in a remote town as a young person who has no vision in either of their eyes and is without one of their legs. How was that growing up? I imagine now you're a very active individual. You are sailing all over the globe. What was it like as a child?
It was hard, actually. Most of the time, everyone thought I was doing so well and telling me that I was amazing and, how much I was coping and all this sort of thing. So I actually wasn't particularly, but I didn't want to let anyone know about that, because that was kind of what defined me. It's like, oh, I'm that kid that survived cancer that is doing well. And it was hard too, because a lot of the focus in rural schools is sport, and there aren't that many children anyway, so everyone's running around at lunchtime playing footy and basketball or chasey and things like that, and I'm sort of not able to do any of those things. So I sort of spend a lot of time sitting, you know, on the sidelines reading books and not really interacting much with the kids. So it was quite isolating. At the same time, as I said before, I was sort of held up as a bit of a inspiring person, which I got a bit frustrated at, because, you know, I was like, look, it's not that inspiring. All I've done is lived, really. I haven't really made a decision to do any of these things. I've just, you know, spent my life just keeping on going. And so I felt like I was being held up as an icon for something that I didn't really believe in. And in fact, I started getting a bit anti-cancer fundraising, anti-cancer research, and all that sort of thing, because that was all I was labelled as. I was a kid that survived cancer. And to me, that wasn't something that really defined me at all. It was just a thing that had happened.
It must be frustrating when that becomes not just part of your identity, but to a lot of people, that is your entire identity. I know now that we know you as Carly Forth, the medal-winning championship blind sailor.
Yeah.
How do you feel about, when you talk about as a child, how do you feel about reflecting upon that?
Gosh, yeah. Soon as I left school and started sailing and went to uni, socialising and getting groups of friends and being someone else or sort of doing more than just school and having survived cancer, I was much more excited by that, and I felt much more I was really happy to share that identity. It's like, look, I'm a sailor now. Like, I took up sailing, did all sorts of things I would never have expected that I could do, started travelling around the world and really kind of pushing those boundaries, really, yeah, sort of can now sort of say, look, I've won a gold medal. I worked hard to get that gold medal, and I'm proud that I got it. And I was proud even before that I was, you know, sailing and representing my country and even just being able to do something so empowering.
It's always interesting how when we grow up, our opinions of ourselves change and our opinions of the world around us change as well.
Mm.
You mentioned, Kylie, about not growing up somewhere near the coastline or near any water. Tell us, how did you come into the sailing world?
Ironically, it was one of those inspirational things that got me there. It was my high school nominated me for the state Youth Minister's Positive Image Award, which I think every district high school had a nominee for that. And I was apparently had the most positive image in my school. So I got that. I was, you know, one of goodness knows how many nominees. And then I became a district finalist and then a state finalist. So part of that process was that I'd won a voyage on the Lewin, the tall ship Lewin, of my choice. And so I, of course, wanted to do the most expensive, longest version of that trip because I was getting my money's worth, of course, as a 15-year-old. Unfortunately, the Lewin had other ideas, and rightly so now that I look back on it. But at the time, I was very unhappy.
Getting a bargain.
Yeah, I know. I thought I was getting a bargain. They decided that because I had a disability, I needed to sail on the disability-specific voyage, which was heavily subsidised, and as it turned out, was amazing. But I, as a 15-year-old, was like, no, I'm not going to do this. I want the one that I want. So I sort of spent 2 years fighting them and fighting the inevitable, because the voyage happened during school time and I was heading into year 11 and 12 and studying TE and all that sort of thing. I was like, look, far more important to study than to go for a week on a ship. Gosh, my priorities changed later on. I would quite happily go off for weeks on end during uni semesters and defer exams and all sorts of things later on. But at school, that was very important. So I didn't sail on that voyage until I was 18. And to cut a long story short, I decided that I wanted to learn to sail first before I went on the Lewin, because I didn't want to look like I didn't know what I was doing. So I happened to have an invitation to a come and try day with Sailability WA and went and tried. And to my delight, there was quite strong wind that day. So I got out on the boat and it started speeding up and heeling over, and it was great fun. I was hooked from that moment. I think if it had been a very light wind day that day, I wouldn't have gone back, because I quite like going fast and slightly adrenaline type activities. So really lucky that I was able to get it just on the conditions that I love. And then I was also lucky that at the time there was a few people there who were really invested a lot in teaching me to sail and put a lot of their time and effort into one-on-one training with me for that first year. So I really did get a good foundation, just found a sport that I could do. And because I'd lived in the country, I didn't really know that sailing was a thing. And I'd spent all of my childhood sitting on the sidelines looking at other kids doing other sports and not being able to participate. So I was really excited to have found something that I could do and do well and enjoy.
It was that thing of right time, right place when you hopped on that sail,
yeah,
come and have a try day. Talk to me about the moment when you realised, Kylie, I'm actually pretty good at this and I reckon I could keep having a crack at it.
It did take some time, because the thing about sailing is you can't just start and do it. It's not like a running race. Everyone can run. I mean, you can improve your technique, but you kind of know the general principles. Whereas sailing, you get on the boat, there's all these ropes going everywhere. There's big sails up there that you can't reach and can't see, and a boom that swishes around uncontrollably. It turns out it doesn't, but it seems at the time it does. And all the different words and all the different concepts you have to learn. So it took quite some time to realise that I was good at it, I guess. I guess I loved it, so I was putting all the effort in it. It was a real opening up the world to me and opening up a whole different group of people and something that I could do. So I think the first time I even contemplated going further was I'd been put in touch with a blind sailor in Victoria, because the people who were teaching me could only go so far. No one had taught a blind person to sail before that I knew. No one that I knew of had taught anyone with vision impairment. So they were saying, oh, look, you really need to look at these things up here on the sail, the telltales, and if they're flapping, you adjust the sail. But I couldn't see them. And I was getting a bit frustrated that I was still relying on someone else's sight to do something that I really liked doing and wanted to be independent and wanted to pull my weight on the boat. So I got in touch with this other blind sailor who had just won the World Blind Sailing Championships. I thought he would know what he was doing. And he started coaching me over the phone and telling me what to start looking out for and to tell my coaches what to teach me. Out of the blue, a couple of conversations later, he actually asked me to sail with him in the next World Championship. And I sort of had to take a breath and like, hang on a sec, I don't know anything about sailing. I don't know anything about competing internationally. And here's this world champion skipper asking me to sail with him. So it was very exciting. And of course, I jumped straight in and did as much training as I could and sort of met him in Singapore on the way to Italy, and then had a day to practice in Italy and then had a regatta to sail. So
Oh my gosh. Yeah. That's like Ian Thorpe calling up and saying, can you jump on the relay team for this
Absolutely.
Olympics?
Absolutely. It was crazy. So I had done, obviously, I'd been sailing a little bit before. Like 2 weeks after I did my first come and try day, I'd been asked to participate in the state championship, which, again, I had no idea what
in
I was doing.
In 2 weeks?
I know. I think they were just looking for people. They were a bit stuck for crew. So it was the disabled sailing championship, but my team won silver that day, so that was, we were pretty good.
Oh my gosh.
Obviously, I was good at following instructions. So
This all sounds very promising for somebody who just had a crack at it.
Absolutely.
Out of sheer stubbornness of not wanting to rock up to the Luan.
For sure.
And not know what they were doing.
Yeah, no, the great thing about blind sailing is there are very few people doing it, so you can go quite far quite quickly.
That, but also you do have to be supremely talented at what you do, which clearly that yep. has been the case.
Yep.
Talk to me about when you're on the boat, when you're sailing, yep. not competitively, what's going through your mind? What are you focusing on or I guess not focusing on?
Yeah. I've got several different roles on the boat, depending. My favourite role is the main sheet, which is the middle of the boat, the engine of the boat, essentially. But I do this only in club racing because when I'm blind sailing, no one else wants to be skipper, so I have to skipper. So as a skipper, I also quite love skippering, actually. It took me a long time to love it, but now I do. It's quite stressful and it's quite hard. What I'm focusing on is I basically shift my attention probably every 5 seconds. So I think, where's the wind? Can I feel what the wind's doing on my face, on the side of my neck, on my arms, any exposed skin? What angle is it to me? Is it increasing? Is it decreasing? Has it shifted anywhere? Then I'm also thinking about the angle of the boat. Is it tipping more? Is it flattening out? Is it staying steady? Then I'm listening to the water along the side of the boat, along the hull. It sort of gurgles and splashes along at the side there, and that's my speedo. So is it gurgling at the same speed, or is it slowing down? Is it getting more noisy? Therefore, we sped up, which is a good thing. Then I'm thinking about when I'm steering, I've got the tiller in my hand, so I'm feeling the pressure of the rudder against my hand, against the helm. So it's like, is that feeling neutral? Is it pushing one way or the other? Has it gone slack? And then in blind match racing, we have a whole nother level where we have audio signals on the marks and on the boats as well. So then I'm sort of listening to the sounds of where the marks are and kind of trying to put a mental map in my head about, okay, where's that sound coming from? I do have crew. They're very important. Their job is to, one, trim the sails, and two, to listen to the marks and things as well. So they're kind of feeding the information to me about, oh, yeah, so I've got the mark at 10 o'clock or whatever. So we sort of use the boat as a clock. So the bow is 12 o'clock, the stern is 6 o'clock, so straight in front of you is 12, to left and right is 9 and 3. And so we put everything, like the direction of everything is in relation to the boat, because it doesn't matter which way you're facing. Everyone knows where the boat's, you know, where the boat's going. So I could be facing one way, my crews are facing a different way. So their 10 o'clock is not my 10 o'clock. So everybody knows where the boat's 10 o'clock is. So it's sort of a standard kind of measure. So I'm listening to what the crew are telling me. I'm putting that into my mental map. I'm checking with them to think, oh, yep, I agree that I can hear that mark at 10 o'clock. Then I'm also thinking, where's the other boat and what's our next move? Because as skipper, I'm also doing tactics. So I'm trying to do the strategy, kind of like the game or the chess game almost. It's like, look, I'm trying to get our boat going fast. I'm trying to, you know, work out where the other boat is in relation to us, where we are in relation to everything else, and then think forward, how are we going to get to where we want to be before they do? So there's a lot going through my head as a skipper. When I'm sailing, because there's two different formats of blind sailing, it gets a bit confusing. So there's one which is match racing with the audio signals, and that has all vision impaired people on the boat with no sighted assistance, mm-hmm. and just radios to communicate with the race committee and things. So they tell us anything, any flags, anything that's displayed, they announce it over the radio. All of these information that's feeding into my head, and my head's just, by the end of the race, I'm just so exhausted, mentally just wrung out. The other format is fleet racing, where we have two sighted people on the boat. So I'm still skippering and I still have a blind main sheet hand, but I have a sighted jib hand and a sighted tactician. And the two sighted people are there to, the jib hand is there to help us sail the boat faster and sort of most accurately, because we can sail pretty accurately just by feeling it and hearing it, but nothing can trump being able to see it and see the slight flutter in the sail or all that, just that tiny, like, little correction that might make us go that little bit faster. And then the sighted tactician is doing all the thinking that I was telling you about before, the where are we in relation to everything else and what do we do now? So that kind of takes a lot of the load off my head. All I have to do is keep my head in the boat and sail as fast as I can and focus on just keeping the boat going and sort of following instructions a bit, which I'm less good at. I like to be in charge.
Look, Carly, I asked that question thinking you were going to be like, yes, it's really calm and I'm at one with my thoughts. And you just gave me like the most comprehensive crash course in competitive sailing.
Absolutely.
Songlines is a new RTFM podcast shining a light on First Nations artists across WA. Join me, Cesara Krishnaz, as I sit down with creatives across music, theatre, dance and television, paving the way for the next generation of storytellers. Stream now on iTunes, Spotify and rtfm.com.au.
There are some people who quite literally could not find their way out of a paper bag, let alone out at sea. And you've just walked us through there how sight is not necessarily the main sense that needs to be relied upon when you are competitively sailing.
Of course. And in fact, there are quite a lot of good racing sailors who will deliberately blindfold themselves and train blindfolded because they have to try and learn all those other cues that then that sight sort of trumping, and it makes them better sailors.
Isn't it the irony in yeah. the thing that you grew up with having to navigate the world without your sight and, yeah. and maybe necessarily in a world that's not fit for people who aren't able-bodied and fully sighted.
Yeah.
But then you step onto a sailing boat and it all just kind of falls into place.
Yeah.
It's lovely.
It does take a lot of training. Like, this didn't happen all at once, and sort of there's a lot more repetition and kind of time on the water and just relearning and concentrating and all that sort of thing. So when we do lots of training, we do really well. When we don't train, as you would expect, we do terribly.
Like any other professional athlete.
Absolutely.
Talk to me about your blind sailing team, Lost at Sea.
That name was coined just before the 2014 World Match Racing Championship. It's Lost at Sea, S-double-E, which is a pun, which I really didn't like at the time. It was one of my other crew came up with it. It was a bit cringeworthy, but I quite like it now. We've got a logo and all sorts of things. We used to be Ranga Racing because I've got red hair. And one of my crew and two of my coaches had red hair. I'm like, this is great, because all the professional sailing teams have a name like this, you know. I thought that would be awesome. And we were sailing in Perth at the time, so it made sense and it was a bit fun, and we needed a team name, and that was mine, and I was quite proud of it, as you know, you are when you're first.
You have to explain what a ranger is to everybody.
Absolutely.
Else.
Absolutely. My crew didn't necessarily love it, but they took it on and they humoured me and let me call us Ranger Racing. In fact, Erin, my gym hand at the time in the blind sail, and she has got brown hair, but she tried to dye it red to kind of
fit in. Oh my gosh, the commitment.
It didn't work, but she tried. But when we went overseas, like, it worked perfectly in Australia, but when we went overseas, we kept getting asked, what nurse a ranger? Like, it kind of lost its, took too long to explain. I was like, oh, look, no, this isn't working. So when the name Lost at Sea was suggested, I cringed, and then I thought, okay, look, everyone gets it. It's kind of fun. And yeah, so that's how that happened.
Are there any other blind sailing pun team names out there, or are you the only one?
There are. There, I can't think of any off the top of my head.
It's because Lost at Sea has to be the best one.
People always try to say, oh, you're lost at sea, as in, like, you know, it's not a great name for someone who's trying to win if you're lost. I'm like, look, no, it's not that we're lost on the ocean. We just can't see. So, like,
it also, downplays the ability, makes you a bit of a dark horse or an underdog in the competition.
Oh, we are the underdogs. Everyone loves us. Every time we go over there, there's something, red-headed, one-legged blind skipper and, called Lost at Sea, and then everyone loves Australians anyway. And then I've got, everyone else on the team.
Kylie, are you telling me you're the rock star of the blind sailing world? Because I believe it. Sailing world?
I don't know.
I feel like you kind of are. Okay, talk to me about the World Championships.
Yep.
2014.
Mm-hmm.
It's a pretty big time for you.
It was amazing. I'd been working up to this for 10 years, so... Well, not quite. I started sailing, blind sailing in 2006. Went, as I said before, went to Italy with Paul Borg as a skipper. Met him in Singapore. Sailed one practice day. Sailed nine races, won all nine races. won the regatta. I'm like, I was feeling pretty happy with myself then. I was like, look, I've never done this before. And look, here I am now. I'm top of the tree, you know. Came home, thought I would do that all over again. Then, you know, a few months before the next regatta, Paul had to pull out for medical reasons. And at that moment, he sort of said, oh, look, I believe that you should skipper, Kylie. I'm like, I don't know anything about skippering. This is terrifying. So I had a bit of a think. I'm like, look, okay, maybe why not? I'll take this chance. It's something that's way out of my league, but I'll give it a go. And I rang up a friend, asked him, Ryan, do you want to sail with me in Italy in 3 months' time? I was like, yeah, okay, sure.
Was Ryan a sailor at this point?
Ryan had been, used to sail, but I'd been trying to get him back into sailing for quite some time.
Okay.
And he just jumped at it, and we both sort of bumbled our way through and didn't do very well at all. We went to the regatta, came absolutely dead last, so it was a crushing defeat. I'd been at the top, fell down to the bottom, and then I spent the next 10 years working my way up. And every year I did get another rung up the ladder. So I was improving. And then, you know, in 2010, Ryan couldn't come. So I did the same thing to Erin. I said, look, Erin, she hadn't even learned to sail yet. I'm like, so Erin, you wanted to learn to sail. How about it? You know, and
do on the world stage.
Want to come to Italy? And she's like, oh yeah, that sounds great. I'm like, look, you've got 3 months. And she goes, yeah, okay, that still sounds great. so then we went again to Italy in 2010, and we by that stage we got to fourth on the ladder. So we were getting there. And then from that moment on, every year we sat down and had a team goal planning session before we started training for the regatta. And my goal was always to win. And my coach and my crew would always say, look, no, this is not really realistic. Maybe we should podium. And so I was like, no, we're going to win gold. And every year we didn't quite win gold. In 2014, when we sat down for this planning session, I trotted out my usual, we're winning gold. And the coach just said, yeah, actually, I think you could, which was a real boost. It meant that we'd gotten to that level. And we did take the training to the next level that year. We did on-water and off-water sessions every week and had rules coming out of my ears and strategies and tactics and things. And so by the time we got to Sheboygan in the USA, which is on Lake Michigan, I knew that gold medal was mine. I just needed to get it. And I've never gone into a regatta feeling so confident. And in fact, you know, we sailed beautifully. I knew I could put the boat where I wanted it. My crew and I, you know, we had both Erin and Ryan on board that time because we needed three people. We all knew, we sort of knew that we were good. And we were actually sailing against Luigi Bertanza, who was the Italian, who I'd been sailing against every year for the whole time. He was the one to beat. He'd won it 3 years in a row before. And I'd always, one of our little team projects was like, you know, beat Gigi. That was it. It's like, we've got to beat Gigi. You know, it doesn't matter who else we beat, we've got to beat him. And we hadn't ever done it. The year before, we'd come second to him, and that wasn't quite good enough. So he was there, and we sailed, and it was great. It was a really excellent regatta, and we were sailing really well. And we got through to the finals. Most of our races we'd won, and then we got to the finals, and the first final race we lost, which wasn't quite the plan. But we had, it was the best of first person to 3 points, so like best of five essentially. You know, we lost the first finals race, and then we just went and won the rest, which was great. And so as we were sailing down our last final leg of the course on the last race, the Italians were very long way behind us. And my crew, Erin and Ryan, were like, oh, we're winning. I'm like, no, haven't won yet. Shush, haven't won yet. We haven't got over the line yet. Anything could happen. They could learn to teleport or something like this. The mast might fall down. I don't know. They were not, and I could hardly believe it. I was like, look, we're so close, and I've been aiming for this for so long, and it's here, but I don't want to believe that we've won yet. I didn't want to believe until I got that confirmation, because I didn't want to be disappointed. And so when we crossed the line and we got the hoot, and our coach just screamed, like there's the most ridiculously loud bellow of joy came floating across the water. I'm like, okay, we've won. You know,
we did it.
And it was incredible. And it was really amazing because there were three totally blind people on a boat with no sighted people on the boat. And there was, you know, we'd had to rely on ourselves, rely on each other, had to trust each other with the information that we had. And it was really just like the fact that we'd achieved it. That was like the pinnacle because we could do it all by ourselves. And yeah, it was just so amazing.
It was a massive mark and win for you personally, for your career, for your team.
Yeah.
At the blind community, but also just the Australian sporting community as well. I imagine there was just so much support for you at that time.
Absolutely. And that's one thing that I've managed, and I don't quite know how I do it, but I seem to have gathered a lot of support over the years. And my networks, everyone's like, look, okay, when are you sailing in the next regatta? When are we coming to the next quiz night? What wine are we drinking? Are we buying chocolates? Are you selling honey? What are you doing? I need to buy, you know, like they're almost sort of waiting to find out how they can help us to get there. And it's always so amazing. We've got so many people behind us and so much support and so much encouragement. I think, you know, when I won that regatta, it was a testament to them as well for having given us, you know, trusted in us and given us so much support. I felt that I'd sort of done them proud, you know, like, and, you know, we have also gathered support in the blind sailing community as well, because as I said, somehow or other we end up being the underdogs at the regatta. So even when we start beating them, they still like us, which is...
I think that has more to do with just you as human beings being pretty good people.
Yeah.
But that's good. I want to take a bit of a sidestep from that conversation, mm-hmm. and talk a little bit more broadly about people living with a disability,
yep.
and professional sport. I want to talk about the Paralympics.
Mm-hmm.
So as we know, the Paralympics decided that they wouldn't have sailing as a contending sport at both Tokyo 2020, and they've announced at the Paris 2024 Paralympics, sailing won't be a part of the program.
Mm-hmm.
When you heard that news, how did you feel?
It's devastating because even though blind sailing isn't in the Paralympics and won't be for a very long time, probably because it's not quite acknowledged as a disability sport in the disability community for some bizarre reason, and there's a lot to get blind sailing, there needs to be a lot more blind sailors involved to get it as a legitimate sport. But for sailing and for people with disabilities in general, I think sailing is the most inclusive sport you can possibly have. It's the sort of sport where once you're on the boat, you can make adjustments and adaptations in the boat that helps you to do your job well. And each person with a disability has a different level of you know, slight adaptation that works for them. But once you're in the boat, you're just a boat. Like, every boat can sail against each other. Like, you can sail people with disabilities against able-bodied people, people who are blind against sighted people, young versus old. It's all, everybody is able to sail together in this very inclusive way. And in fact, you know, it is possible for people with disabilities to beat able-bodied sailors on an even playing field. And that's probably one of the only sports where it's possible to do that. And it was really unfortunate with the sailing, because there was only two countries short. There was, I think they needed 32 countries to be participating in sailing events actively for it to remain in the Paralympics. And there was 30 countries. And unfortunately, there wasn't enough participation. It sort of got put out in favour of another sport. So it's taking a lot to get it back in. And there's a lot of discussion around what sort of format it's going to be when it gets back in, because obviously there are a lot of disabilities, and every disability has a preferred boat or a preferred combination of crew or things like that. And so they're trying to get as many minority groups into the Paralympics as possible. It's sort of like a bit of a juggling act between people, what they want, the sailors, and what the International Paralympic Committee will let in, and that kind of wider conversation.
It's extremely complex when you break it down like that. I would have never considered all of the different disabilities and preferences how they go into making that decision.
Yeah.
I love that you mentioned there about for able-bodied people on a boat versus for disabled-bodied people on a boat and how, you know, the odds don't necessarily swing in the favour of the able-bodied people. Is sailing just the great equaliser that we don't know about yet?
I think
yet?
So. It really is. You know, I sail regularly in club racings. There are sailors who are 90, 95, still sailing. That knowledge, you're always learning. There's always something, it's dynamic, there's always something different. So it's all about how you work with your team, how you work on the boat, how you know the weather conditions, how you interact with the other people. And it's, I think it's one of the best sports there is. And it's one I can do, which is even better.
Yeah, you're biased. It's fine. Now, I know that you're not resting on your laurels because you've been competing heaps since 2014. Say this is a perfect world and sailing comes back in whichever format it takes in the next set of Olympics in 2028, will you be training and preparing?
Yep.
That's so exciting.
Yeah, it would be great. It will be amazing. I don't know how, but somehow I became the president of Blind Sailing International last year, which means, so Blind Sailing International is the body that coordinates blind sailing events and basically tries to promote blind sailing, get more people involved, organise regattas and all that sort of thing. And part of that role, it's trying to get more sailors involved so that blind sailing may in the future be considered to get a Paralympic spot or even to be considered as an equal to some of the other disability sailing events as well, because not every single event gets it to be in the Paralympics, and it may not be the be all and end all to get into the Paras either, because it's, you know, it's the most prestigious and it would be amazing. I cannot even imagine how incredible it would be to be selected to be on the Paralympic team and to represent Australia and to be in that arena. But to get there, we need to get a bit more consistency and a bit more, you know, more people involved. And it is a bit of a double-edged sword, though, because blind sailing isn't a Paralympic sport, there's no funding for it and there's not much push to get people involved, because as soon as it gets into the Paras, everyone wants to have a part of it and all of a sudden programs get developed and money gets thrown at it and it shoves it along quite quickly. Whereas if you don't have that, you've got to sort of push it yourself. And there's, you know, some very passionate people around the world trying to push it, but you know, one person per country or one person per continent isn't really enough to get that much involvement.
Which brings us back to those people who have formed this community around you wanting to buy the biscuits and go to the quiz nights, and they're the people that are really helping to pave that way and push that agenda without it
Absolutely.
Even being whispered in the Paralympics at this point.
Yep.
Kylie, I want to wrap up very soon, but let's take you back just a few decades here. Growing up as a young person, learning to live in your body with these new different challenges going on, and like you mentioned before, in your own words, being anti-cancer fundraising and and being quite angsty, which comes as a teenager, but that aside, but then finding sailing, do you look back now and think, I really hope there are some young people living with a disability who know about sailing or maybe know about your story, and maybe that gives them the opportunity to give it a crack?
Yeah, no, I mean, I encourage anyone, and it may not be sailing. I think it should be sailing, but if it's, it may be something else. But all you need to just get out and meet people and sort of get yourself out of that box that you're in. And it's hard. You put yourself in a box sometimes as well. And so it might be really hard to just get out of the house or have the courage to jump off that cliff and think, well, okay, there's this chance and I don't know what it is and I don't know how to do it and I don't know what to expect and I'm not sure. But if you do, it could go terribly wrong, but it also could work, and you may find something that you're passionate about and some people that share that passion, and sort of it really opens up all of the possibilities and all the friendships and really gets you out there and helps drive yourself forward when you don't know what you know, you don't have that push anymore. I find sailing does. It's something to focus on every week, and it's a constant. I know that I'm really, you know that I'm happy when I'm sailing. So, you know, it's good to get out there and do that. I really encourage anyone, you know, anyone to do anything that they want, really.
I love it. Hey, Kylie, what are you working on now? Are you preparing for a new competition in the future?
Yeah, there are championships in France in 2024. So that's what we're going to be aiming towards, picking ourselves back up and getting, you know, even getting more people involved is really exciting. I want there to be several Australian teams at the event because I want to getting more people out there. I want to share the joy of sailing with as many people as I can. So that's the next goal, to get us there and to do well at it and then to springboard into something else and even get Australian championships up and running as well, which would be really exciting.
Oh, we would love that. Kylie, before we let you go, we're also a radio station. We are doing a podcast right now, but it does get aired on the radio. And as part of that, we've got to play some music. So off the top of your head, what is your favourite artist, your favourite song? What do you love listening to pump you up?
I love Ashley Dulles, and one of her songs is called Sail Away, which is quite appropriate.
Appropriate. I thought you were going to give me like a sea shanty, but I'm here for that instead.
No.
One more thing that I want to loop back to is the Women's Hall of Fame. When you got the call to say, hey, we'd like to induct you, what was that feeling like?
I couldn't believe it. Like, I didn't even know I'd been nominated. So it was this really surreal. And in fact, I was told a little bit before the announcement, so I had to keep it quiet, actually, and it was very hard, and I still just could not believe it until I was standing there on the stage receiving my certificate and sort of looking out and sort of seeing all that, all those women. And, yeah, it was very, very amazing, especially, you know, not just a Hall of Fame, but a Women's Hall of Fame too, because there's so few acknowledgements of women in the state. So it was very exciting to be part of that project.
Yeah, very cool to have you in the Hall of Fame as well. You're in there amongst mother sporting greats, some we've gotten to speak to in the last season, and others as well. Kylie Fore, thank you very much for being part of Herstory, and I'm sure that we will see you on the water at some point soon.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks to Kylie Forth and all the women at the West Australian Women's Hall of Fame. And thanks to the incredible women who make Herstory happen. Our executive producer is Danae Gibson. Sophie Minisale and Maddie Lombardi are our assistant producers. Emily Jane Reid is our production assistant. And theme music is an original composition from Annika Moses with artwork by Peter Roebuck. Herstory is an RTRFM podcast series about women in the Western Australian Women's Hall of Fame. This podcast is produced on Whadjuk Noongarrbuja. RTRFM acknowledges and pays respects to the Aboriginal elders of this land, past and present. These lands were never ceded. This podcast was made possible with support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can find out more at cbf.org.au. My name's Taylor Strano, and it's good to be back for the second half of Season 2. Next week, we meet with the woman who has literally thousands of pigs.